All right, we were on the coffee house manager employment contract when I last spoke with you, and I was just going to show that final slide and then go on to the next bit of this. But basically, the problem that we've been looking at throughout is this is a principal-agent problem. The coffee house would like the manager to work hard and do a good job. The manager would like to get paid lots of money and have not have too much risk, and somehow we've got to square all of those objectives. And the first step is to observe that the output we'd like to measure is not the return to the firm, but the return to the particular coffee house he manages, since the problem specified that the firm had good computer systems for monitoring the performance of each coffee house. We have the option of saying his pay depends partly or entirely on how well his coffee house does. And the constraints on that are, first, to what extent can we tell how well it does? You could certainly imagine a manager who avoids all long-term repairs, figuring he's going to only manage this coffee house for a year, makes his bottom line look very good, and then the week after he leaves, everything falls apart. Or a manager who, if you think about the general issue of evaluating things, that sort of in a way the classic example would be Stalin's Russia. Because in Stalin's Russia, everybody knew the reason things were bad was they were sacrificing for the future. And it was a lie. But it was a very sensible lie, because the future isn't there to be observed. So if you tell people, this week you're going to have fresh meat and good food and a nice house, this week comes and they say, you're lying to us. If you say, well, it's too bad, but we've got to catch up with the capitalist West, and that requires sacrifices, sure enough, you deliver sacrifices, and 30 years later, they notice you haven't caught up with the capitalist West, but by that time, Stalin is safely dead, having run his system for quite a long time. But that's a general problem not limited to communist societies, that if you're an employer and you want to evaluate employees, there really, in a sense, are two things going on. One is their effect on the current flow of income, and the other is the effect, as it were, on the capital assets of your firm, and the second one is going to be hard to measure. And what are ways, that is one way you could imagine a manager cheating the employer if he's only going to be there for a year or two, is by letting the facilities get run down. What are other ways he could do the equivalent of that you might want to worry about if you were the employer? How can the manager sacrifice the future to the present? What are the less visible assets, yo?
Well, yeah, maybe he could buy assets that are cheaper, that won't last as long, but that work in the current time.
Yep.
Fine.
That, in a sense, is the same sort of thing, but are there less sort of physical versions about that? How about he hires some important employees, and he says, look, I can't offer you very much for the first 6 months, but if you perform well, I'll give you a big raise at the end of the 6 months. And at the end of the 6 months, he says, well, sorry, but it hasn't gone as well as I thought, but in another 6 months. And you could certainly imagine ways in which you can, as it were, spend your goodwill, in which you can save money in the present at the cost that after a year or two, all the employees are fed up with you and anybody competent is left and so forth. And, yeah. It isn't the same, but yeah, it's got some of the same logic to it. Though a pyramid scheme, each level is getting paid off by the wider level below it, as it were, and so you typically would have more than one level. My point is only, I mean, sort of a general point, but that if you think about all of these sort of principal agent deals, somehow you've got to measure things, and so it's worth thinking a little bit about why the things you care about are sometimes hard to measure. Would be one of them. You want to know what's happening to the reputation of the firm. On the other hand, measuring inputs is also very hard. You may not know how many hours he works. You may not be more interested in how much attention he gives and so forth to working, in whether he takes the opportunity to feel bossy and to raise his status by being nasty to his employees, or whether he says, it's not me, you know, it's the coffee house, and I'll do whatever I have to make people happy. You can think of a big range of those things. Anyway, those are all things that we've discussed. Let's go on to joint undertakings, things like law firms or the example I gave, because when I was first thinking about this stuff, it was fairly fresh, which is that Apple wants to build new computers. The computers require a central processing unit. IBM at the time was producing the central processing units, originally Motorola, but by this time it was mainly IBM, which Apple at the time was using. And so you had decisions by both firms, which were interdependent, that Apple was planning on IBM being able to deliver the processors it wanted at the price it wanted, and IBM was counting on Apple being a customer for those processors. And how do you set up the contract? Well, same kind of problem, that Apple can say, well, IBM will make its best efforts to get a 90-nanometer process CPU running by date such and such, but how do you prove what the best efforts are? How might you do it? Suppose you had anticipated the problem, which turned out to be, as I say, that IBM couldn't deliver what they had said they would deliver. If you were signing a contract in advance, and you say to IBM, look, are you willing to agree to pay us $50 million if you don't do it? And they say, well, we're not willing to pay you that, because really nobody knows for sure if we can do it. We know better than anyone else does, but that's still a lot of slop in it. So it might turn out that it just can't be done, or that it can't be done for a long time. How might you, in the contract, allow for that? How might you set up the contract so that if IBM fails because they haven't made an adequate effort, they'll pay a penalty, but if they fail because the whole project turns out to be much harder than anybody thought, they won't? Any suggestions? You're all techies, right? You live in Silicon Valley, so you're supposed to know all this stuff. What would be the clearest evidence that it was IBM's fault? What would be the clearest evidence that developing 60-nanometer CPUs was indeed doable, even if they hadn't done it?
If a competitor came out.
That's right. Intel was the competitor. Intel was trying to do exactly the same thing, not the same CPU. They also had difficulties, but eventually they succeeded enough so that Apple switched to using Intel CPUs. So you could imagine certainly a contract which says, look, you agree to owe us a penalty if you don't do it and if Intel does. And that especially makes sense because if there's a sizable chance that Apple doesn't do it and Intel does, maybe Apple ought to, sorry, that IBM can't do it and Intel does, maybe Apple ought to be switching its supplier today instead of 3 years from now. So you could imagine certainly trying to do that sort of thing. The problem with saying you agree to be liable for our losses is that Apple's losses depend on decisions by Apple as well as by IBM. If you think about a law firm, a lot of what I gather law firms really do is they try to somehow separate out the contribution of each partner in terms of what customers he brought in, what billable hours he did. Now that's not going to be all of it because obviously somebody is paying the secretaries and somebody is an office manager and there are presumably a bunch of people whose works don't divide, but at least you're going to have a good deal of it divided up in that way. The problem with that, as we've seen in other contexts, is that if it's a pure reward by outcome, if the outcome is uncertain, somebody may go hungry this year. So if people can't afford those risks, you may want to have a compromise in which it's partly a reward by input, partly a reward by output. Sale or lease of property. All right, this is a very, very common kind of contract you may well be involved in, at least those of you who aren't doing criminal defense work. And obviously one of the problems, in fact, probably have all of you rented an apartment at some time or other? Was there a security deposit? Do you believe the landlord treated you fairly with regard to the security deposit? You didn't. What?
The amount of the initial down?
No, the question is, was it the case either that you returned the apartment in good condition and they didn't give you back the... the possible outcomes are A, you trashed the apartment, in which case you have no complaint over there, compensated in the security deposit. B, you returned the apartment in good shape and they gave you the security deposit, but C, which is the interesting one, is you returned it in good shape and they held the security deposit. What were your experiences? Which one would
you? I had seen one time where we had been literally hired people to clean the house and paint the walls and whatnot, to take the nails out and the screws in,
yep,
all over the paintings. And we still were charged for a security deposit upon upon receiving the deposit. We were charged for painting and cleaning. And so I called the manager and I'm like, how did they get, multiple hours of cleaning? And I'm literally watching the people I already paid to complete the job. And I can't understand how this even slides by. They eventually just gave me 50% of what they took off.
Yeah.
So it was charged.
Was the amount they originally took off the full deposit that you had made?
It was a portion of the entire deposit.
So the original thing was they were giving you some of your money back.
Right.
And you persuaded them to give you more of your money back, but not as much as you think they should have.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Other people's experience?
I've done it where I cleaned it myself. I cleaned up part of the satisfaction and it's been returned essentially in the same position.
And did they return your deposit?
He didn't want to return my deposit.
Did he?
So I argued with him,
Because in a sense, at the point we'll be discussing later, but the sort of one of the issues in a whole lot of this is that either side can cheat. And that often the precautions that prevent one side from cheating make it easier for the other side, too, in a sense. So the security deposit has the advantage that if the guy just sees your security deposit, he doesn't have to go to court. That saves some costs. It has the advantage that he knows you can pay it because he's already got it. But it has the obvious disadvantage that it makes it easier for the landlord to behave opportunistically. And of course, one way you could respond to that, if you thought you couldn't trust the landlord, is you don't clean up the apartment. You say, all right, instead of cleaning up the apartment, he keeps a security deposit, and what I get back is the money I saved in not cleaning the apartment. And that's sort of one possible option.
Trash the place and write off the security deposit.
Yeah, right. Well, deliberately trashing it doesn't do any good. But not bearing costs to fix it up, as you said.
Well, unless you enjoy trashing it.
Yeah, unless you enjoy trashing it. That's true. But what all of this suggests, and what my article that you've now read is really about, is how you structure a contract if you assume you aren't going to go to court. How do you structure a contract in ways that as nearly as possible achieve the objectives of contracting without involving a judge and a jury and such? And my claim is that that's of interest not only in the somewhat exotic settings that I'm discussing in the article, but in the ordinary work of a lawyer. That really, if you've done a good job, part of the evidence is you don't end up in court. Part of the evidence is you've set up the contract in such a way that it's never in the interest of either party to cheat the other. That's not always a soluble problem, but it's sometimes a soluble problem, and then therefore we're thinking about it. So one dimension with property is the quality both of... Does the house or apartment meet the conditions that you thought it did when you agreed to it and when you give it back? And one issue that gets into is what are you obliged to tell? And I'm thinking of two rather neat real-world law cases. And one of them has to do with the question of what is or isn't fraud. To what extent, if I don't lie to you but don't tell you things, am I engaged in fraud? And this was a real case that happened as a result of the War of 1812. That, as some of you may know, the last battle, in fact, the one important battle in the War of 1812, the battle that made Andy Jackson a hero and got him into the White House eventually, was fought after the war was over. Because the negotiators were in Europe, the war was in America, and they didn't have radio or telegraphs. And so the word hadn't gotten back. And one effect of the War of 1812 was a British blockade of U.S. commerce, because Britain had a much bigger navy than the U.S. did. And one result of that was there was an awful lot of tobacco sitting in New Orleans that nobody could sell because they couldn't export it. And apparently somebody in the business somehow got word of the treaty 12 hours or 24 hours ahead of everybody else. And so what would you do if you were a tobacco dealer and you were in New Orleans in whatever it was, 1814 or so, and you somehow found out that a peace had been signed? Yep.
I would buy up all the tobacco.
You would buy up the tobacco. Well, so did he. And 24 hours later, if you were one of the sellers who had signed a contract agreeing to deliver a certain amount of equity, what would you do?
I would sue, arguing, I guess, that he didn't disclose all the information.
That's right. You would, that he did, and he lost. But it's an interesting case for just that reason, because it's exactly the issue, is it fraud if you don't disclose relevant information, but also don't misrepresent the relevant information? The information was, after all, public information, national information, which you happen to have first. And there's a sense, of course, in which it would be very hard for futures markets and such to work if you took a very strong line about having to disclose information, because one function of those markets is to give speculators an incentive to try to figure out what's happening in the future. And if every time I get a better information on what's going to happen in the future, I've got to disclose it to everybody, I'm not going to make any money out of that information, so I won't generate it. But, which is an argument for the decision the court reached. I don't know what the current law is. This was a case 200 years ago, but it's a neat case. The other case is the Poltergeist case, and that's sort of fun. This is a modern case where a house was sold and the sellers neglected to inform the buyers that there was a poltergeist, that there were supernatural phenomena that were occurring in this house. And it was pointed out in the course of the trial, where the buyers wanted, I think, to rescind, because they thought having a house with, I'm not sure if the buyers believed in the poltergeist or only believed in the reputation of having a poltergeist, but either way, they didn't want the house. Apparently, the poltergeist wasn't a secret to anybody else. The people who owned the house had written articles about it and done publicity and, you know, made a big thing about they had this haunted house. And so the judge's view, the quote was, legally speaking, this house is haunted. He didn't care if it was really a poltergeist, but the sellers had forfeited the right to claim it wasn't haunted by repeatedly and publicly claiming it wasn't. So I think he did give them the right to rescind. But those are both sort of fun cases on the general issue. I have a discussion in one of my books of the Treaty of Paris one, and I don't think it works anymore, but I originally, when I set up the web page that had that on it, if you mouse over it, you get there's a hidden link, one of these things where you only see it because the mouse is, because the cursor symbol changes, and it's a link to the song The Battle of New Orleans. You know, you all know the Battle of New Orleans. You know, we fired our guns and the British kept a coming, but there weren't so many as there were a while ago. We fired once more and the British started running down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Anyway, I won't pretend to sing it because I can't sing. That would be cruel and unusual punishment, but it was fun. If you're ever doing sort of webbed things, it's sort of neat putting in secret links so that people have fun in discovering them as they're mousing around.
Easter eggs.
Yeah, Easter eggs are another version of the same thing. Mine is sort of a low-tech version of that, except that I think the link's broken now. I've got to go back and find another web version of that song that's not there. What about the case where you're renting property and the question is, in the contract, who bears the risk of, for example, a fire? So that he's the landlord, I'm the tenant, I'm renting his land and barn and whatever, and raising animals, doing whatever I do. And the question is, one question is under common law, what happens? The other question is in the contract. What are the arguments for the contract specifying that if the thing burns down, it's my fault, legally speaking? What are the arguments for saying it's the landlord's fault?
You want to say it's the tenant's fault. You want them to worry about it. You want them to take care of it.
The argument for what I think was the common law rule, which is that it's the tenant's responsibility, is that the tenant is the one in physical control of the property. He's the one who does or doesn't smoke by the haystack and does or doesn't make sure that the oil lamps are put out when there's nobody around, whatever precautions are relevant, and that therefore if he bears the cost, he's got an incentive to take greater precautions. But there might be an argument, depending on the circumstances, on risk spreading grounds the other way. If the landlord owns lots of properties and the tenant, this is his whole life, as it were, it might be that the tenant would rather be insured by the landlord, even if he had to pay a higher rent to get those terms.
Also, for certain things, why would you want to make permanent changes to the property that you don't own? Why would you want to ensure the safety, continuing safety for 10 years down the road for something you don't own?
That's right. If there were particular issues which had to do with whether or not there was an expensive sprinkler system, something of that sort, those would be issues where you want to give the incentive to the landlord because he's the one who will control it. That's, of course, the point you're raising is a general issue. It's, in a sense, the same point I was making from the other side about the employee running down the firm's reputation in order to make the bottom line look good for a while, that similarly you want to think about, in any case where long-term ownership and short-term ownership and control are separate, how you get the short-term person to make the right decisions for the long-term, and vice versa. That part of my theory about how feudal property relationships worked, I'm not sure it's right, is that the serf had a customary dues that he owed the lord, which were not freely negotiated each year. They were essentially fixed by custom. And one argument for that is that the serf now has an incentive to make investments in fertilizing the land and improving it and such, knowing that the lord can't appropriate them next year by just raising the rent. So that's one argument for those long-term contracts sometimes. How about a loan? You're lending money, and you've got to worry about various risks when you're lending money. And one obvious risk, the extreme risk, is I lend you $1 million. 6 months later, you go bankrupt. I discover you've got no assets. Why do you have no assets? Because your $1 million was used to buy from your brother-in-law some worthless things for $1 million. And oddly enough, after you did that, you bought a new house. All right. So that the extreme case in the loans is how do I protect against fraud? But the much, in a sense, more natural case is how do I protect against risks which are sensible for the borrower to take, given that they're my risks and not his. All right, this was the problem a lot of people pointed out with the savings and loan crisis, that in effect the government said to the savings and loan, if you make money, you get to keep it. If you lose money, we'll pay it. In fact, the comment which somebody, I forget who it was, someone fairly prominent, made a couple of years ago about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was that the privatization of the government-created entities had privatized profit and socialized loss, and that that was not a sensible arrangement. And it's true in the government case, it's true in the case of the private lender, that if you owe me $1 million and you've got a firm whose total value at the moment is a little more than $1 million, it's tempting to take risks where if the risks pan out, your firm is worth $2 million, you pay me off and pocket $1 million. If the risks don't pan out, your firm is worth zero, and I lose $1 million instead of you. All right, so then how does one control that? You're the lender now. How do you keep people from doing, short of fraud, from simply acting in ways that you wouldn't want them to act for that reason?
You can have
them
secure the loan.
One of them is that they have assets they're not allowed to sell or to borrow money against other than from you, and you get those assets if they go broke. Sure, that's an obvious way. But the other thing in principle you can do is to say they have to conduct business as they're conducting it. Any major change, such as going to Las Vegas and betting the Treasury, has to be approved by you. All right? But the problem with that, of course, is the reason they're running the firm and you're lending money is they know more about running firms in this industry than you do. So you have to worry about whether, on the one hand, whether you might prevent them from doing things that are important for them to make money and be able to pay off the loan, and on the other hand, whether they might persuade you that things were prudent enterprises that really weren't. So this is obviously a problem. Not an easy answer, but a problem. Final point is... is resolving disputes, given that, as I think my father always used to put it, there isn't enough 8-point type in the world. You can't cover all alternatives in the small print of your contract. And we live in an uncertain and complicated world. What we want to avoid is opportunistic breach, where by opportunistic breach I mean breach which occurs only because it lets me benefit at your expense. What we don't want to prevent is efficient breach in which fulfilling the contract would on net make us worse off, and therefore we want to end it. And the standard stuff, which you've probably all had before, the sort of standard damage rule that you're told is expectation damages, which say that if I breach, I must make you as well off as you would have been if I hadn't breached. And that leads to efficient breach. Unfortunately, it leads to inefficient reliance. What do I mean by inefficient reliance? I mean that you, the potential victim of a breach, are deciding whether to do things that are a good idea if I don't breach, but not if I do. So that you're deciding, I've agreed that I'm going to buy a million customized widgets from you. And you can either produce the widgets in the factory you've got, or you can build a new factory, which will be a cheaper way of producing them. And you say to yourself, if he's going to breach, I certainly don't want that new factory. I'll just be scrapping it when I'm done. But if he's going to fulfill the contract, then I want the new factory. If we have a contract in which I'm going to owe you expectation damages if I breach, how do you decide whether to build the new factory? Whether to rely on my fulfilling the contract. That's why it's called reliance. Anybody? Suppose we say, look, if I breach, then the contract is going to result in a loss of $100,000. If I don't breach, it's going to result in a gain of $50,000. In deciding whether to build the factory, what kind of calculation do you do? In a world of expectation damages.
So the buyer has the option of losing money or gaining
money. No, who loses it is going to probably depend on the breach and the damages. But let us imagine that the seller says to himself, producing these goods will be my costs if I end up, if the contract goes through, will be $50,000 lower if I build the special factory. If the contract doesn't go through, the special factory will be a $100,000 loss. You, as the producer, how do you decide whether to build the factory?
Well, you can determine whether what's the odds of the contract going through or not.
Do you have to know that?
Well, if it's going to be break even, then
what happens if the contract doesn't go through? You signed the contract. The question is whether the other guy is going to breach. What happens if he breaches? No, you aren't, because if he breaches, he's got to make you as well off as if he had fulfilled. If he breaches, you're up 50,000.
Yeah.
Right? If he doesn't breach, you're up 50,000. You see? Under expectation damages, he's got to make the result come out for you as if he had fulfilled his side of the contract. So that means that in deciding whether to bet on his fulfilling the side of the contract, you don't have to know the odds. As long as the court's going to actually be able to force the damages. That makes sense?
Yeah, but it's reliance, and you're only going to be at zero instead of at plus
50. I'm saying if it's expectation damages. Yeah, reliance damages, though, you still don't. As reliance damages also don't give you efficient reliance if you work it out. What does give you efficient reliance? How do we set up the contract? Suppose we know all the facts coming in except for the one thing that's going to decide whether he breaches or not, which is some external event. And suppose we say, look, if he breaches and you don't build the extra factory, that's going to cost you $100,000. How do we set up the contract so that he both has the right incentive to breach and you have the right incentive to rely? What in this case, if we know the numbers, is the superior alternative to both expectation and reliance damages? Anybody?
Liquidated
damages, of course. Because if the agreement is that he's going to owe you a fixed amount of money, then if he breaches, you're $100,000 worse off than if he hadn't breached. He gives you the same damages whether or not you were alive, right? So if with liquidated damages, when you make the reliance decision, you say to yourself, if he breaches, if I built that factory, he's not going to have to compensate me for the factory because we already agreed on how much he has to compensate me. It doesn't depend on whether I build the new factory. So therefore, liquidated damages, if you can estimate what the amount of damages are going to be, are in that respect superior to expectation damages. Or if you like, liquidated damages set at what expectation damages would have been. Anyway. negotiating the contract, we've already been through this. Basically, you want to try to maximize the size of the pie, and you also want to maximize your share of it, while remembering that being too greedy may mean no pie at all. Any questions on that stuff before I go on to the fun stuff, or at least what I think is the fun stuff here? No? All right. You've read the book. The stuff's getting boring at this point. We've spent enough time on it, I think. All right. The article came out in part of two different seminars I've on here. In that case, in that sense, it's a Santa Clara University article. One was on legal issues of the 21st century, where I was thinking about how would an economy function as it were if it were functioning largely online. And the other was on legal systems very different from ours, where one of the many legal systems we look at is indeed Imperial China, which is a fascinating legal system in a whole lot of different ways. On a digression, one of the things sometimes cited about the horrors of totalitarian governments is that they force children to inform against their parents. In Imperial China, say in the 18th or 19th century, if you were a child and you discovered that your father had broken a law and you went to the district magistrate and told him, what do you think would happen?
You'd be punished for disobeying your parents.
You would be punished by the magistrate. That's correct. It was a criminal offense to accuse your parent of a crime, even if he was guilty. I think I know the reason. I think what's actually going on in that system is that they're ruling a population of something over 100 million people, which by 18th or 19th century standards was a really big population, with this tiny elite bureaucracy. As you may know, the Chinese invented the civil service system. And the Chinese system was one in which you had this elaborate set of examinations, which were not examinations on whether you knew administration or law or anything like that. They were how well you could write poetry, how educated you were in the classics of Chinese literature, a whole bunch of weird stuff. But which required you to be very, very bright, because it was like, you know, they're selecting whatever, the 500 best people out of 100 million kind of thing. And the people who did very well in the exam ended up as bureaucrats. And there weren't very many of them. And so how do you run a big population with a tiny elite bureaucracy? You subcontract the job. And what does that mean? It means you find other authority structures, of which the extended family was the most important one. You turn over a large part of the job of controlling their members to them, and you back them. And part of backing them is saying the child can't threaten the parent with exposing the parent's crime, which would undercut the parent's control over the child, because it's illegal for the child to expose the parent's crime. So anyway, it's a digression, but it's sort of quite neat. If any of you ever take that seminar, which those of you who are third years aren't going to have a chance to do, but those of you who are second years could, I found it enlightening to look at a whole bunch of different historical societies with different solutions to the same problems that all legal systems come up with, of which that was one. Anyway, but one result of that was a legal system which essentially didn't have contract law. That's a slight exaggeration, but not much of an exaggeration. And such contract law as they had largely wasn't enforced. That we know, for example, there were legal maximum interest rates which were routinely violated. And we know about it because Taiwan was ceded by China to Japan about 1900. And the Japanese, probably sensibly, decided that it would be a mistake to try to impose Japanese law on a Chinese population. And then what they wanted to do was to try to continue to enforce the existing legal system. And if you, the new rulers of Taiwan, want to enforce the existing legal system, what's the first thing you're going to have to do? What's the first step in order to enforce the Chinese legal system? You've just conquered Canada, and you want to enforce the Canadian legal system on Canadians instead of imposing American law. What's the first thing you're going to have to do?
Keep the Canadians in charge.
What?
Keep the Canadians in charge. They know how to run it.
That might be how you do it, but I expect the Japanese did the same thing. First thing you have to do is find out what it is.
Yeah.
All right? So the result is that we've got as our source of information on the Imperial Chinese legal, as one source, legal system, this like 20-volume report done by a bunch of Japanese scholars in 1900 who questioned the locals to try to find out what the legal system was. All right? And they got a lot of information on legal dealings and some modern English speaker wrote a chapter of a book which summarized this. This is my source for this article. But one of the features of the system was that there was very little contract law. And they didn't really, as far as I can tell, have civil law as we understand it at all. So that it's pretty clear that if I lent you $1,000, you didn't pay it back. Suing you was simply not one of my options. There was no mechanism. That what I could do in the legal system was to go to the district magistrate and accuse you of being a swindler. That's a criminal offense. The district magistrate now takes over the case. I've got no more to say about it. And the district magistrate has the option of saying, I don't believe you. He's a nice guy. He's bribed me generously. Not going to listen to the case. He has the option of saying, well, thank you for telling me about that crime. I'm going to have him tried, convicted, and flogged. Your $1,000, that's your problem. He has the option of saying to you, pay him the money or else I will have you tried, and anything in between. So it's really a criminal and a civil case. It makes it very hard for lenders to use the courts to enforce their rights. Yet it turns out that without that legal support, they had very elaborate contractual practice. That in fact, they signed future contracts, they signed contracts of various sorts. We've got the records of that. And that was sort of, in a sense, the puzzle of that system. And the flip side of it, the other half of the article, is that I've been arguing for a long time that we're moving towards a world in which contract enforcement online is going to depend almost entirely on private rather than governmental mechanisms for a variety of reasons I'll be discussing. And therefore, I thought we had this nice parallel. How do you set up contracts in a world where you can't get the government to enforce them? And then, for purposes of this course, this also becomes interesting because even if you can get the government to enforce them, you'd rather not because that's costly and reveals private information and all sorts of other things. So when you're drafting a contract, you want to try to draft a contract in such a way that nobody wants to violate it. And the problem in cyberspace requires a digression. How many people here know about and think they understand public key encryption? This is a serious defect in your education, which you, those of you who didn't raise their hands, but you share with many other people, because it's a really important technology. It's one of the technologies that's changing the world gradually. I want to communicate privately with you, and other people might intercept the message. And the traditional way of doing it is encryption. I scramble the message, send you instructions on unscrambling it, and then when you get the message, you can unscramble. Do you see the flaw in this system?
Someone intercepts the key.
The problem exists because I don't have a safe way of getting messages to you. So how do I get the key to you? How do I get the unscrambled information? And it's sometimes soluble. Maybe I handed the key to you when we were in the same place and then sent you a message 6 months later. Or maybe if we're both parts of a government, I sent a military attaché with a briefcase handcuffed to his wrist, you know, in a special plane with the information to you. But for ordinary people in their ordinary transactions, it's not a very satisfactory arrangement. Public key encryption was a discovery, by now it must be about 30 or 40 years ago, of a way of scrambling messages that uses two keys. The keys are just long numbers. And there's a mathematical way of essentially randomly generating this pair of numbers which are related in such a way that if you scramble a message with one of the numbers, you need the other number to unscramble it. Either way, if you scramble with key A won't unscramble it, but key B will. If you scramble with key B won't unscramble it, but key A will. That idea makes sense to people? Not how you do it, obviously. That requires somebody very clever. But what do I do with it? I create a pair of numbers. I label one of them my private key and one of them my public key. My public key I broadcast to the world. I put it up on bulletin boards. I send it to everybody in the Christmas cards, whatever I can do to get it well known. My private key never leaves my hot little hand. You want to send a message to me. You encrypt the message with my public key. Send it to me. I decrypt it with my private key. He has stolen my public key, that's just fine. He can send me secret messages too. But since the public key won't decrypt what the public key encrypted, the result is that however many people have the public key, no problem, I still have secrecy. furthermore, it means that you don't even have to know me. As long as I've got some way of publicizing my public key, you can send secret messages to me even though I've never heard of you. All right? So that solves part of the problem of how people can maintain private communications in the kind of online world where you never know who's intercepting your communications. If you think about how email works, as you probably know, if I send you an email, it isn't that my computer calls up your computer and sends a message. My computer, in effect, calls up a computer somewhere in the world which it thinks is in the right direction, sends a message to that computer. It calls a computer somewhere in the world that it thinks is in the right direction. Message bounces through five computers and finally gets to your computer. How direct it is going to depend on the particular geometry of the links that we have, but no particular. Anybody controlling any of those intermediate computers could, in principle, keep a copy of the message for himself. So in that world, there are good reasons for people to want ways of encrypting, ways of scrambling their messages. And public key encryption gives you a good way of doing it. We have a second problem. Imagine we're a world where you're interacting with people all over the world who you've never met. And you've dealt with somebody named John Smith a bunch of times, and sure enough, he's reliable, he does a good job of what you're hiring him to do, and so forth. And you get a message which says, you know, I've got some free time, I'd like another job, signed John Smith. And you say, great, here's the job, here's $5,000 in digital cash to pay for your programming, whatever you're doing. And 6 months later, when nothing has showed up, you email John Smith, and he says, huh, I never sent you any such message. All right, you haven't seen the guy's face. How do you know when you're interacting with people online whether they're who they say they are? Can you see that who they say they are is really two quite different things? What are the two identities that you have for these purposes? One identity is your real space identity. All right, if somebody wants me as a consultant on something that David Friedman is believed to be an expert on, what they care about is whether the person who they're paying to do this consulting work is really David Friedman. But suppose I establish an online identity. I establish a reputation as a particular online name, as it were, persona, and it has nothing to do with David Friedman. Maybe I don't want it to have anything to do with David Friedman, because what I'm giving people advice on is how to evade taxes, or how to break the law in some other way, or something else that's unpopular. Or maybe I'm a novelist writing novels that the Iranian government doesn't like. You can think of various reasons why I might want to have a reputation, but not link that reputation to my real space identity. Right? Public key encryption lets me do both of those things. Because a public key private key system enables digital signatures. How many people here think they know how a digital signature works? All right, you know they exist, right? Doesn't do any good to just scribble a signature. Anybody who likes can copy that and paste it into their document. When I occasionally get something by email which is, you know, a document and I'm supposed to sign it and send it back, sign it in the literal sense, and it's really a pain printing it out and signing it and mailing it, or printing it out and signing it and scanning it, I don't do any of that. I take the document on my computer, I take the picture where I've taken a picture of my, where I scribbled my signature in AppleWorks many years ago, I paste it into the document and send it on. Well, the guy who received it can copy that and paste it into a document too. It doesn't prove it's me. All right, it's a completely useless exercise except for making somebody happy. Digital signature, the basic idea is that the way I prove a message is from me, once you know what my public key is I encrypt the message with my private key. Remember, each of them undoes what the other one does. I take that encrypted message and I email it to you and I say, this message is from David Friedman. You've got his public key, don't you? Sorry, his private. Yes, his public key. You use my public key to decrypt the message I've sent you. The part telling you it was from David Friedman wasn't encrypted. It was a separate part that was. It comes out as a message, not gibberish. You therefore know that it was encrypted with the matching private key, therefore by me, because I'm the only one who has that private key. The real digital signatures don't work that directly, but that's the guts of how a digital signature works. And it depends on the fact that I have a secret private key, you have a public, a known public key, and with your public key, you can tell that a message was decrypted, it was encrypted with that private key. That can be used in two quite different ways for verifying two kinds of identity. Let me describe you my business plan for violating the laws of the state of California. All right. I should say I've got a more exotic business plan for setting up Murder Incorporated, but I won't go through that on this occasion, though it makes a good story. But all I want to do is to sell legal advice. The only problem is I'm not a member of the California Bar, and there are severe restrictions, therefore, on my ability to sell legal advice. But that's all right. We live in the 21st century, and these problems are soluble. So I set up a website hosted in some country that turns a cold eye to subpoenas from the U.S., and the website is the website of Legal Eagle Online. And I solicit legal questions. And each legal question that comes, I post the question and I post my answer. And people who would like to buy cheap legal advice look at this website. And they observe, and then they consult with their own lawyers. And the lawyer says, yep, he got it right. Yep, that's the right answer to that question. Yep, that's a good answer to that one. Yeah, that's a pretty good answer to that question, too. And after I've done this for about 6 months, and have convinced people that Legal Eagle Online really knows this stuff. I can't really do this, I should say, because I'm not, in fact, a competent lawyer. But let's assume, for purposes of my hypothetical, that I am. Now I start charging. Now I say, send me messages. I'll send you back answers to your legal questions, but I expect to be paid for it. How do I make sure that someone else doesn't free ride on my reputation by pretending to be Legal Eagle? That's simple. All legal communications are digitally signed. And one of the first things I did when I set up the website was to publicize my public key. So the Legal Eagle Online website has got my public key all over it. And even if someone else manages to hijack my website, they don't get the private key because that's sitting in my own machine or maybe on a flash disk somewhere in my very careful possession. And therefore, it's probably in my pretty new Santa Clara Law School flash disk, which they just gave me today. I don't know if they gave it to you or not, but for some reason these were attached to some kind of a handout that the faculty just got. That's a pretty little flash disk. You say, speak nicely to the librarians, they might give you one, because that's who the thing came from. So what happens now is that I can prove to my customers that I'm really the person who is giving this good legal advice without ever revealing the fact that I'm David Friedman, who lives in San Jose. Which is very convenient, because now when the Bar Association tries to come after me, they've got no idea who I am or where I am. So what does this mean? It means that public key encryption makes possible the combination of anonymity and reputation, which on the face of it sounds impossible. And yet, with public key encryption, I am anonymous in the sense that the link between my online persona and my real space persona only I have, but I have a reputation in that the online persona has a reputation. It's really quite a neat thing if you want to think about possible futures. And it turns out to have some attractive and some unattractive features. And the unattractive feature is that it makes possible criminal firms with brand name reputation. That's where my Murder Incorporated comes in. And the attractive feature is that it reduces the ability of governments to control people. Other people to control people, too. Because it means that however much the government of Iran dislikes my novel, I can not only write the novel, I can collect donations online from people who like the novel, thinking of the Salman Rushdie case, of course, and the government of Iran can't find out who I am. And similarly, for those of us who believe that making it illegal to practice law without being a member of the bar is a mistake, that everybody should be free to give legal advice and up to the customer to decide what their conditions are, it makes it harder for professions to maintain their monopoly by making it illegal to practice the profession without their stamp of approval. So it has desirable and undesirable features. What I'm really interested in, which is getting beyond this particular course, but I think is not getting beyond education in general, is the way in which the world might change if you have a world where people can combine anonymity and reputation. And that, I think, is going to be an interesting world, and you people are probably going to live in it for longer than I am, unless they solve the aging problem, which is one of my other future hopes. All right, so this is the summary of how it works. And that means that that technology lets you do that. But one implication, the implication that's most immediately relevant for us here, is that in a world where many people choose to do business anonymously, you cannot use the court system to enforce contracts. Because you can't sue someone if you don't know who he is. And it's even true in a world where people aren't trying to be anonymous, but where people are doing business online, which means the guy you're contracting with may be in India, he may be in China, he may be next door, you mostly don't know and don't care, it becomes hard to use the legal system. Because what laws apply will depend in part on the two parties. What laws you can enforce on him will largely depend on the jurisdiction he's living in, and that gets to be a real mess. And that suggests that just as in Imperial China, we are going to have serious incentives to try to structure our dealings in ways that don't depend on court enforcement. That's sort of the bottom line of the side. So this is running through some of the reasons. Some of the reasons for anonymity, I should say, probably stronger abroad than here. If you're in any country where there is a serious risk of violation of your rights, either by the government or by enterprising neighbors, you may not want it known that you have a good income selling your services online. All right? So how do we enforce things without the government? And I think there are two core mechanisms, although lots and lots of combinations. One of the mechanisms is arrange your dealings in such a way that if everything stops, you've got the right result. So that, for example, if the result we want is if I renege on my agreement, I pay you a $1,000 penalty, then have me post, make a $1,000 deposit. That's your security deposit. All right? That has a problem, as we've just seen, and the problem is that covers my reneging on the agreement, but not your reneging on the agreement, because now you've got $1,000 extra incentive to double-cross me in order to hold the deposit. But in any case, I'm going to argue that you can nonetheless get a lot of the way there. That if you take a very, very simple case, which is you're hiring somebody to build the house, to build a house. And one way of doing the deal is that you say, look, $100,000 house, here's $100,000, let me know in 6 months when you have a house. And 6 months, when you don't hear from him, you look around and there is no house and there's no $100,000. All right? Well, how do we solve that problem? That's very simple. I say, look, I want you to do a $100,000 house. When you got the house in 6 months, come and I'll give you $100,000. Now what's the problem? They build the house and you say, well, that's a very nice house, but it isn't really the house that I wanted, and you know, it doesn't quite fit what I said in our conversation. I'll give you $50,000 for it. And if he doesn't have another buyer for that particular house, he's stuck. So how do we routinely solve that problem? How do we avoid a situation where either party can make a killing by reneging?
Yep. Installments.
Installments. So that we say, all right, I'll pay you the $5,000 you need to do the initial work. When you've done that, I'll pay you another $5,000, and so forth. And the result is that at each point as the contract progresses, if I pull out, I'm not going to get a benefit. I've put a bunch of money in, and there's a half-built house. If you pull out, you're not going to get a benefit because you spent that money. What's the limit to that? In principle, it sounds like that solves the whole problem, right? Just structure your contract in such a way that at each point, whoever is bearing costs has gotten enough reimbursement. Whoever is getting a benefit is paid enough so that it pays neither to pull out. What's the fly in you? I mean, in the real world.
Well, some things happen all at once, or some things have an high initial cost, and you really have to decide that.
That's going
to
be one problem. What's the other problem? Yep.
You have to determine who's going to pay or is going to fulfill their promise first.
Well, I was thinking of something like a house where it sort of is more or less continuous.
Right, it's more or less continuous, but am I going to pay you the rest of the money first, and then you do like the last couple of things to the house?
Well, but as long as I'm doing it in small enough stages, nobody can ever make very much of a killing by defaulting, right? I've paid the first $85,000, and you spent the first $85,000. Here's the next $5,000. Well, the most you can do by walking now is to steal $5,000. But the other problem is that the world is unpredictable, And that therefore, even if we've set it up in such a way that we intended that step by step at each point, it would pay nobody to default, it might be that something changes. So to take the very simple case, the contract is for my selling you a certain amount of grain at a certain price. That contract is in both of our interests. I'm a good supplier of the kind of grain you want. You're a good customer. But partway through it, the market price of grain shoots up. And I say, wait a minute, I want to pull out of this contract because I can sell the grain to someone else at a higher price. And you can think of a lot of changes that could occur such that even if the original plan exactly synced things so that at each point, if you stopped at that point with that amount paid, each person would lose until the very end when each person gains by the completion of the contract. Nonetheless, in an uncertain world, that's not always going to work. And you'd like to have some wiggle room. You can give wiggle room in one direction by having a deposit, which means that I have to not only be 1,000 ahead, I've got to be 10,000 ahead because you've got $10,000 of my money, but that then gives you an incentive the other direction. All right. There is an interesting solution to this problem, though, and it's a very old solution to this problem. And the solution is that instead of deposit, I give you a hostage. What's the difference between a deposit and a hostage? A deposit, when you confiscate the deposit, I lose and you gain. A hostage, when you kill the hostage, I lose and you don't gain. All right? Very old solution to this kind of problem. Let me tell you a true story. At least it's probably a true story. Any of you know about the Stephen and Matilda troubles in early English history? When Henry I dies, he has no living son. And he swears everybody he can get to support his daughter, the Empress Matilda, Empress because she had been married to the Holy Roman Emperor at some point, on behalf of her, I think at that point, infant son, as the heir. And lots of people agree to that, and he dies, and before Matilda can get herself into power, her cousin Stephen, who is something like a nephew, I think, of the king, makes it to England, gets crowned king by his brother, I think, who's the archbishop, and announces that he's now king of England. And they spend about 14 years fighting each other, which was apparently a very unpleasant civil war. And it eventually settled with a deal in which it was agreed that Stephen would be king until he died, but that his heir would be the young Henry, who ends up being Henry II. And Stephen dies a year or two after that, whether naturally, I don't think we know. In the middle of this, there is a gentleman by the name of, I think, Gilbert Marshall, who is one of the barons who are engaged in the Civil War. And Gilbert was, on the whole, a pretty honorable fellow, as barons went at the time. He only switched sides once. He started out fighting for Stephen, then after a while, Matilda offered him a better deal, and for the rest of the war, he fought on Matilda's side. And at one point during the war, Gilbert is holding a castle on behalf of Matilda, and Stephen shows up in front of the castle with an army. And Stephen says, "Surrender or I'm going to siege or storm this castle. You don't have a very big garrison. I'm going to do it." And Gilbert says, "Let me make a deal with you. I don't want to get my people killed. You don't want to get people killed in the process of taking the castle. So the deal is that you give me 3 days. If Matilda doesn't show up with an army in 3 days in order to relieve the siege of my castle, I agree that I will yield the castle to you without a fight." All right? Stephen was confident Matilda had no army available close enough to relieve the siege, so he said, "Sounds like a good deal to me. There's just one problem. How do I make sure that after 3 days you keep your word?" And Gilbert said, "Well, I've got this kid. Name of William. Hand the kid over to you. Hostage. If I double-cross you, you can kill the kid." Stephen says, "It's a deal." Stephen has other things to do with his army, so he goes off for 3 days and does something else. Gilbert spends 3 days hiring troops, taking in supplies, and getting ready for a siege, because he also knows Matilda has no army close enough to relieve him. Stephen comes back and says, "3 days are gone. Give me the castle." Stephen says, "Ha ha, fooled you." Gilbert says, "I'll kill the kid." Stephen says, "I have 3 more sons, and have I not still the hammer and the anvil with which to forge more?" And Stephen, as it turned out, was insufficiently hard-hearted to carry through on his threat. And there are various stories. The reason we know this story is that the kid, who is William Marshall, ends up as the most famous knight in Western Europe, and before he dies, he's regent of England for John's son. So he's quite a major figure in sort of 12th century English history, and this is his first adventure, as it were. But it does sort of show the theory, at least, of the hostage system, is that you can create a system in which neither side has an incentive to double-cross, because the guy who has the hostage gets nothing by killing him, but the guy who gave the hostage loses something by letting him get killed. So there are these mechanisms. Now, hostages don't have to be literal hostages, all right? A hostage is really, for these purposes, any way in which one party can injure the other if he thinks he's been cheated. And the very best hostages are the ones that only work if you have been cheated. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Let's think about reputational enforcement, because that's an important alternative to legal enforcement. The basic logic of reputational enforcement is that if I cheat you, you tell other people then choose not to do business with me, and that makes me worse off. And what's interesting about it is that they aren't trying to punish me. All right? We usually think of enforcement as, why does the court award damages in order to punish me for cheating you? Reputational enforcement, why do they damage me? Yeah, they don't like you. You're not a friend of theirs. They just don't want to get cheated themselves. All right? What does this mean? It means that in order for reputational enforcement to work, it's important that other interested third parties be able to find out that I cheated you. And it's important for a second reason. Because let's suppose that I did in fact cheat you. When you complain, I say, no, she's lying. She tried to cheat me and I just wouldn't put up with it. That's what happened. You're an interested third party. You don't know who's telling the truth. What is your conclusion? Very good. Don't do business with either of us. Too hard to find out. Lots of other people in the world. Why take the risk? If you know that they're going to respond, what do you do when I cheat you and you can't prove it? He's just told you that if you announce to the world that I've cheated you, the result is that you're going to lose reputation as well as my losing reputation. So what happens when I cheat you? Nothing happens, exactly. You swallow the loss. What does that mean? It means that reputational enforcement only works if interested third parties can cheaply find out who's telling the truth. If not, the victim has an incentive to keep quiet as well as not being able to prove it once he doesn't keep quiet. And I want to argue that one way of looking at arbitration, which is a very important way in the real world of settling commercial disputes, I would guess a majority of all commercial disputes, is, as you may know, international commerce is mostly run through private law and not through government law, that a large part of what's going on with arbitration is that arbitration is a way of making it cheap, of enabling reputational enforcement by making it cheap for third parties to find out who's at fault. Because if we're in an industry where there is a well-established arbitration mechanism, the Diamond Dealers Club in New York, for example, and you accuse me of cheating you, and you insist on arbitration, if I refuse arbitration, that's a public fact. The arbitrator will say, she asked for arbitration, you turned it down. Everyone in the industry says, he's obviously the villain. If we go to arbitration and the arbitrator awards damages, I don't pay them, again, everyone in the industry knows I'm a villain. So it's a mechanism of using a trusted third party to lower the cost to all the other third parties of figuring out who's at fault. And my claim is that this works even better in cyberspace than in real space because of digital signatures. Because in real space, it really depends on the third parties being a part of the same network, being other diamond dealers, other people who know whether or not you really agreed to this arbitration and whether or not it's a competent arbitrator and such. In cyberspace, when we sign our contract, we include the specification of the arbitrator. Both of us digitally sign the contract. I'm imagining now a fully anonymous world, but where each of us has a reputation in cyberspace. Each of us has a reputation linked to his public key. That means that my digital signature on the contract proves that I, this online persona, agreed to the contract. Yours does similarly. The contract specifies that he's the arbitrator. He's a professional arbitrator, we've both agreed on. and the contract includes his public key. All right? Now I double-cross you. I don't deliver the goods. You demand arbitration, and you go to the arbitrator and to me and say, I want arbitration. And I say, ha-ha, fooled you. I'm not going to accept the arbitration. So you go to the arbitrator and you say, please write me a statement that legal online, who had agreed in this contract arbitration, refused to abide by your arbitration. He writes the statement, he digitally signs it. You now have a package. You have our contract, which proves that I agreed to him as the arbitrator. And you have his verdict, which proves that I reneged on that agreement. Anybody who can check the digital signatures can check that his digital signature fits the public key that both of us said was the public key of our arbitrator. So that means that at essentially zero cost, any interested third party who sees that package of documents can check that I agreed to his arbitration and then reneged on that agreement. So my claim, at least, is that this gives us a mechanism for doing online arbitration and thus online reputational enforcement superior to what now exists in real space. And that I'm arguing, at least, is likely to become important in the future. Oops. All right, let's keep going. I ran the order in which I've been talking turns out not to be the same as the order of the slides. Let me go back for a moment to a different version of the point I was just making about the problems of opportunistic breach, about trying to structure the contract, and tell you about... Did I discuss Lloyd Cohen's article with you before? I keep getting confused because I've got two courses that are covering some of the same material, my law and econ course and this. And did I discuss the issue of I gave him the best years of my life?
Yes.
I did. All right. That's this slide, basically. And the argument is that marriage is a long-term contract. It's a contract where one party typically performed early and one party late. In principle, the argument we've been making suggests what you should have had happening was the husband should have been putting money into a bank account belonging to the wife year by year as they produced the babies and raised them, and then the money should have come back as the wife retired to bridge playing and socializing once her kids were all in school, and the husband was earning a good income as a senior member of his firm. But that's not the way marriages were structured. It would be a little tricky given community property and various other rules, and it therefore raised opportunities for opportunistic breaches. Right? So this is the point I was just making about that one solution is you just try to design the contract so there's no point at which either party gains by breach in terms of the structure of the payments. Another is to use a hostage in order to keep it from being a sort of a razor edge case where too much deposit you breach, too little deposit I do. But a third solution is to combine the reputational mechanism with the deposit kind of mechanism in the situation where only one party has a reputation. And you can think about this in the real world case, that if I'm buying from Apple Computer or from a department store, I really don't have a reputation. All right? Maybe I have a little bit because of credit agencies, but I'm not planning to borrow money. And short of credit agencies, the next person I deal with is not going to know whether Apple thinks I cheated them or not. On the other hand, if Apple cheats me, I got a web page, I got a blog, I got lots of friends, I got lots of email. I'm not going to tell the whole world, but they could easily end up with 1,000 people thinking that Apple's not a company to be trusted. So that suggests that I might be willing to structure contracts where I have to trust them and they don't have to trust me. For example, I buy a computer from them. I pay them money. They deliver the computer. Well, all I see is, you know, this nice box which says it has a computer in it. I don't know there's a computer in it at the point when I pay them the money. At least I don't generally open it when in the store. Even if there's a computer in it, all I'm really seeing is this shell. I mean, I don't know if there's a hard drive in that computer or what software is on that computer. All of that stuff, I'm trusting them. Now, it's true, I have some recourse in that case to the real-world legal system if they really gave me an empty box and I paid them $1,400 for it. But to a large extent, neither of us wants to be engaged with the real-world legal system. And one way we do it is setting it up so that initially I am trusting them and they don't have to trust me, so that they make sure that I'm really paying them. They don't send me the computer and then I send them the money. But I do give them the money, and they give me a box, which I trust has a computer in it. So I'm going to suggest that quite a lot of real contracts, I suspect, are one-sided for just this reason, that you have a contract which is set up to minimize the legal recourse of the customer. People complain about that. They say, look, what a dishonest, biased system this is. And one possible explanation is, no, this is an optimal contract because the customer has a better recourse through the reputation of the seller, and the seller doesn't have a better recourse through the reputation of the customer. That's at least a possible interpretation of what's going on. Another way of avoiding the courts is if you don't have a reputation, you rent somebody else's. And an escrow agency is the standard way in which you do that. I'm buying something very expensive from eBay. Instead of my sending the money and him sending me the goods, in which case if the goods aren't as described, I've got to get the money back. Or he's sending me the goods and my sending him the money, in which case if I don't send him the money, he's out of the problem. He sends the good to an escrow agency. I send the money to an escrow agency. I then inspect the goods. If I'm happy with the goods, the escrow agency releases the goods to me and the money to him. If I'm unhappy, the money goes back to me and the goods go back to them. A very standard way of dealing with these things. Neither he nor I needs a reputation. Only the escrow agency needs a reputation to make sure they don't seize both the goods and the money and leave both of us out in the cold. All right? So, and then finally, the point I made earlier, so far as possible, structure the contract in such a way that with no court or intervention, you get the right result. Caveat emptor is an example of that. That's what happens if nobody sues anybody, that, you know, you've got the car, it doesn't run, tough luck. That was part of the deal. In the Chinese case, they were very reluctant to have contractual forms in which the goods became yours while I still had possession of them. Because how do you enforce that? Whereas if we say, all right, we're going to assume that ownership goes with possession, once you possess it, it's hard for you to get it back, and therefore we don't have to enforce the rules. All right? And accounting. This is the introduction just to help you think about the stuff we're going to be doing next week. As I say, rule one is that debit and credit usually mean the opposite of what they sound as though they mean. This is, I should say, a general problem in many different fields, including economics, is that you have terms that sound self-explanatory and aren't. And therefore, people take it for granted they know what they mean and get very confused as they go further into it. And that's true of economic efficiency, and it's true of debit and credit. As a general rule, but not a universal rule, credits make a firm worse off and debits make it better off, which is exactly the opposite of what it sounds like. However, there are cases where that isn't true. And by the end of a couple of weeks of accounting, hopefully you'll be able to make sense of how the terms are used, but on the whole, most things avoid the terms that revise things. Second rule about accounting, which is the one that I think explains the general insanity of accounting rules and makes them a reasonable idea, is that there is a trade-off between realism and complication. So that if you ask, how much is this company worth? And the real answer is a very complicated answer because the company has got assets that were bought 20 years ago and some of them are worth much more than they were then and some of them much less. And the company has reputation, which might be worth a whole lot, but which is sort of hard to put in a scale and measure. It's got a bunch of other things. And you could imagine, if suppose you were thinking of doing a takeover bid for a company, what you would want is not just the accounts. What you would want is to have somebody who really knew the company and the industry to go spend 6 months deciding what the company was worth. All right, what's their reputation? That piece of property they have, how much does it really sell for? Are the key employees on the edge of leaving? A bunch of stuff like that. And you would then say, all right, that's really a $600 million company. I'm going to make a $400 million offer for it. With luck, they'll accept it. Accountants can't do that. Because the accountant is generating information which people are going to want to use who didn't themselves control the process of generating it. So if you imagine that the accountant is supposed to decide how much this land, which is not actually on the market, is worth, if the accountant is hired by the firm and the firm wants to persuade lenders that the firm is in a good position, the firm says to the accountant, why, a piece of land just like that sold for $6 million last month. And it's true, it's just the only difference is that piece of land had oil underneath it and ours didn't. And if you want, similarly, you're the firm, you want to persuade the lenders to lend you money, and you say, why, everybody knows we're the best firm in the industry. We've got a brand name reputation that's worth $50 million. No way of measuring it, no easy way of telling. So what the accounting is trying to do is to set up rules for evaluating things that are simple enough so you can't easily fudge them. And the cost of that is that they're wrong. The cost of that is that the piece of land which was bought for $100,000 20 years ago is on the books for $100,000, even though land in general has tripled its price in that period of time. All right, so in a sense, I think what you want to think about when you're trying to make sense of these rules is how do you have a set of rules mechanical enough so that it's reasonably clear, it's never perfectly clear, what the number comes out of it, and therefore you don't have to worry about who is putting a thumb on the scale one way or another, and come as close as possible to getting the right answer. And that's what I think accounting is about. You'll hopefully see that as you read the chapter on accounting in here, which is presumably written by people who know more about the subject than